Okay.
And here we are on a Monday night. Why does it seem like Thursday? I get confused. The pandemic. Where are we with the pandemic? A lot of people are holding their breaths right now. Flu season is about to start. Will there be a second wave? We keep getting these delayed announcements of a new kind of coronavirus when, in point of fact, it's just the Italian strain, which I believe was first publicly identified right here by Dr. Henry Nyman. So where is it going? What's happening? All I know is the political amount of news and information is really, really pressing hard on everybody. And as I have said, and I'll repeat it, news and information are now the number one spectator sport, put quotes around that if you want, in the country. It's not football. It's not basketball. People are afraid. They're watching the mainstream media, and they're being conned in a very large and substantial degree because it's really not news. It's programming. That's why they call it programming. Programming the public. Teaching them how to think, how to react, and that's what happens to most Americans. Not those who are listening to this program, not you who are listening from wherever you're listening all around the world, and bless you for that. Thank you for being here. You care, and you understand. We've got a lot going on in the coronavirus forum. As I mentioned several weeks ago, things had begun to change. There has been a major change in the equilibrium of the way the virus is perceived by the masses now, a change in the texture of the news stories. Let me just read a few headlines for you. These aren't my writing, but they're news stories. They're getting a lot of talk. People are actually becoming very confused now. Based on the latest CDC data, the Wuhan coronavirus, as some call it, poses very little death risk for people under the age of 50. The statistics are quoted and talked about there. Why a coronavirus or COVID-19 surge is very likely this fall and winter. There's another story about it becoming a seasonal disorder, which I think Henry was first to mention that as well, long time ago. Trump announces a plan to deploy 150 million coronavirus rapid test kits, previously touted as being terrific. Let's see. CDC Director Redfield is concerned that Scott Atlas, Henry's good friend and colleague, is sharing misleading information with the president. No, Henry doesn't like Scott Atlas. Neither do I. But that's another story. Trump's coronavirus advisor Atlas fires back against the Redfield criticism. You can follow all this like a soap opera. But here's one that kind of sticks out. After 48,000, this is a Gateway pundit, pretty good site, pretty credible people there. After 48,299 coronavirus cases at 37 U.S. universities, there are only 2 hospitalizations reported and 0 deaths. These, again, are younger people. The Imperial College of London, you remember that flap. Their model predicted 68,000 coronavirus deaths in non-lockdown Belarus. The real tally of dead there, 813. So they went with a non-lockdown policy, and it wasn't 68,000, it was 813. Let's see. Well, there's a whole bunch of things here for you. Coronavirus has been found in Lake Superior at Duluth beaches. People are worried about that, but waterborne transmission is very unlikely, so I wouldn't give it a second thought. Just use common sense. Common sense. Big trouble in Latin America. The coronavirus lockdown, it's terrible in Argentina and other countries. No milk, no meat, no bread, no cheese. Hunger is rocking Latin America. The food chain down there is broken. All right? All right, that's enough. Let's bring on the man of the hour, Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD. Welcome back, Henry. Crazy out there.
Well, it's good to be back. Things are definitely heating up.
Speaking of articles, one just came out of the New York Times about an hour ago or so. And the title is Behind the White House Effort to Pressure the CDC on School Openings. Quite a damning piece.
Got someone like that yesterday. Maybe it was the same thing. I covered it. Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you.
Okay. Well, it was updated an hour ago. So I don't know that this, I think this came out tonight. It says updated 10:19. Tonight.
This is a new one. The one I saw was not as probably as complete or thorough, but it did mention White House pressuring of the CDC yesterday. I saw it. It doesn't matter. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Well, this one gives the details, and they're pretty bad. I mean, Robert Redfield and Deborah Birx are not placed in that good of a light. But the efforts, the main effort of the White House was to basically get the CDC to say that young people weren't at risk and didn't spread the virus, neither of which is accurate. And they put a lot of pressure on the CDC to come up with guidance and to emphasize that, to de-emphasize the risk and pretty much point out the benefits of getting all the students back in school. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was a lot of pressure that was put on the article. Details, it kind of blow by blow. This is essentially why Olivia Troy resigned, who was Pence's assistant in the task force, and he resigned a couple of weeks ago or so. And it sounds like this effort by the White House to influence the CDC and to basically modify the guidelines led to her resignation. And I'll just read you the second to the last paragraph, which I think really sums it all up. Good. And hold on, let me get down to the bottom. It was on July 23rd, with hours to go before the new guidance was to be published, the White House staff secretary further stunned CDC officials by emailing the guidance to a long list of top White House officials asking for any, quote, critical edit by 1 p.m. The list included Mark Meadows, chief of staff. Okay, I'll editorialize a little bit. Dr. Mark Meadows, chief of staff. Dr. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law.
What?
Dr. Larry Kudlow, the director of National Economic Council, and Dr. Stephen Miller, White House policy advisor. And they were going to put in critical edits to the CDC's guidance on schools. So, I mean, I think that says it all. As I've said many times now, Trump is basically anti-science. He's got these task force members, which have no background with anything to do with science, and they're doing critical
edits. Dr. Jerry
edits.
Kushner. I like that's good.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Jerry, right. So, so that's in the article, and it pretty much gives you a good idea on what's going on. And then the other article you mentioned with Robert Redfield was overheard on a plane saying that the bodybuilder, you know, Scott Atlas, I think he's Charles was his father or something.
But, oh, come on.
But anyway.
No. Are you serious? Oh,
no.
That would be funny.
No.
Now, Pete, see, nobody knows who Charles Atlas was except me.
Yeah,
I'm the only one beside you. That's funny.
Yeah.
Dynamic tension. So, remember that one?
Yeah. I don't know that they're related. Scott Atlas isn't that young, so maybe it's his brother. I think they're, but I mean, Scott Atlas is retired. I mean, he's a, I mean, they say he's a radiologist, but he's a retired radiologist. I think he's been retired for 10 years. So, and he has, you know, no background in virology, epidemiology, public health. He's a retired radiologist that has a lot of opinions that are basically, not supported by the scientific community, but he is the the latest advisor on the task force for COVID. And Robert Redfield, I guess, is on a plane and talking about Scott Atlas and says that he's got way too much influence and everything he says is wrong. And that kind of sums up Scott Atlas also. So the bottom line is that the White House is trying to drive the discussion or guidance on the virus and doing it under cover of the CDC. The scientists, the CDC, don't agree with anything they're putting in, and they're putting it in under the CDC's name. And other scientists are saying the CDC would never say this. They would never say it this way. I mean, the CDC, if they talk about the virus, they talk about SARS-CoV-2. They don't talk about the virus as being COVID. That's the disease. So scientists usually make those types of distinctions. The politicians have no idea what they're talking about. They think COVID sounds good. They probably don't even know what COVID is. And so they use terms inappropriately. And most scientists, when they see this, say that it wasn't written by a scientist. But those are the efforts that are going on. Things are heating up. And the gateway pundit that you quoted, I mean, that's only been two cases. That's nonsense. I already told you about the Ohio State. He's dead. He was 20 years old.
And
football player, right. They missed him. Yeah, they only have two people. Two people hospitalized out of 48,000. I mean, that's crazy talk. I mean, that has nothing to do with anything. That basically college students end up in the hospital. They don't die at the high frequency, but they do end up in the hospital. They do end up in the ICU. And to say 2 out of 48,000 were hospitalized.
I don't know where they got that.
What planet are they on?
Well,
That's an absurd statement.
I don't know who did it. They're fairly competent. Right. I have not had a problem with them before. Right. However, let me ask you this. Are we back to the same dog chasing its tail thing where the more we test, the more cases we're going to have? It looks to me we've got 7 million cases, right, in this country out of 327 million people, allegedly, something like that. Where are we? Where are we with this?
Well, I'll tell you where we are. Today, they recorded the 1 millionth death in the world. So the world death toll has now hit 1 million. So that the 1 million dead are not because they're testing too much. A lot of these countries really don't test nearly enough. I mean, a good example of that is the UK. The UK said that they're up to 6,000 cases a day now. That's an all-time high record, but that's not really the record. And the reason that's not really the record is because when Boris Johnson got infected, they had a lot more cases and they had a lot more hospitalizations, but they didn't have 6,000 confirmed cases a day because they weren't testing very aggressively. So that the too much testing argument is just another sense argument. I mean, there are numbers, there are metrics. The CDC says you should have the percent positive below 5%. So if you've got the percent positive above 5%, that means you're not testing enough. New York has got their percent positive down to 1%. So they're doing aggressive testing. Yeah, they got up to 1,000 cases a day last week for the first time in many months. So the numbers are actually going up. But for these
What's the CFR in New York now? Do we know? Confirmed cases? What do we got? Where are they?
The number of deaths or the number
number of deaths from confirmed cases. What is it in New York now? Have they made progress there too?
They're still in single digits. I think today today was a big number. They had hold on, I got up to the top here. They had 12. They got to double digits today. They haven't been at double digits in a while. I think they got up to 10. They've been mostly in single digits. Today they registered 12 deaths. They registered 834 cases. They did 866 yesterday. So and the reports for today and yesterday are really Saturday and Sunday numbers, and Saturday and Sunday numbers tend to be on the low side. They're not fully staffed. They don't, you know, necessarily get the reports recorded, and they kind of play catch up during the week. So the numbers will be higher tomorrow, and that'll gradually increase during the week until you get to the weekend again. It's really 4 days a week that they get reasonably high numbers, and Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, they have relatively low numbers. But New York doesn't have that many cases. Like I say, they're running at about a 1% positive. Now, to give you an idea, in Florida says, things are just about all done. You know, we don't have everything to worry about. Let's open up the bars, open up the restaurants, let them go at 100%. Not a problem. No masks required. And what do you think their positive rate is for Florida today? Today when they're opening things up. Well, they're at 10%. So that means A, they're not testing enough.
No.
B, the number of cases are significantly higher. They should be doing enough tests. So they're only 5%.
Well, in two or three weeks, there's going to be real trouble.
Yeah.
In terms of numbers of confirmed infections.
Yeah. Right. There are 10%. The CDC's recommendations are you don't lift things until you get it down to 5%. So they basically aren't anywhere near 5%. They decided that, it's time to open things up. They open things up based on the calendar. It has nothing to do with what the situation is. And it's, like you said, getting ready to go into flu season. Flu season will start in a couple of weeks or so. It'll start next month. Right. And people will start, it'll start getting cold and rainy out, and then it'll be cold and snowing out. And people will be spending more time indoors, and they'll have holiday break over between Christmas and New Year's, and that'll move a lot of people around and have more interactions at home, and the students will go home with the virus, and that is the concern with the transmission. This whole herd immunity thing. Well, you should let the teenagers get infected because they do well with the virus. Well, when they get infected, they take the virus to their parents and grandparents, and
basically nobody thinks in linear thought like that. Progressive thought just doesn't seem to apply.
And any epidemiologist thinks that way, and they know that. I mean, that's part of the reason that the recommendations for vaccines for flu were lowered to to 6 months because they didn't used to vaccinate children for the flu virus. And then they did studies and they thought, well, the reason the way the virus transmits is the parents and the grandparents get it from their kids. So if the kids get the flu, they go and they pass it on, and that's one of the major transmission routes. Well, the same thing happens with COVID.
What did you say? I'm sorry, I missed the number. How young are children supposed to get this quadrivalent flu vax now?
They can get it according to 6 months. 6 months.
Jeez. Isn't that a load on the kid's immune system? At 6 months?
Seems no, that's what be. It's... That's when it's developing. That's why.
So it'll sit right in there and nestle and become part of it.
No, that's when you're teaching your immune system what's foreign and what isn't and what they should react to. And that's why H3N2 is so deadly, is the older population. When they grew up, there was no H3N2. H3N2 appeared in 1968. So if they were, if they were baby boomers, they basically got exposed to H1N1. And so when they were children and getting the flu, they recognized H1N1 as the virus that causes flu. And then when H3N2 came along and they were a little bit older, they really didn't do that well with H3N2. And that's why H3N2 is more deadly than H1N1, because most of the deaths are elderly with the flu also. And the older population grew up on H1N1. So giving the children exposure when they're younger, that they mount a response. And the vaccine, as you said, is quadrivalent now, so they get exposed to all four viruses and can recognize those as being foreign, and that'll help them when they get older. But speaking of the flu, I think it's worth reiterating, kind of what happened with the swine flu, because the COVID is likely to be tracking with swine flu. And if you recall, back in 2009, swine flu really started in the spring. It started in the end of the flu season. So there was some activity in like March and April, but things got established for the swine flu like April and May, because the swine flu was spreading and the competition, H1N1 and H3N2 flu, were fading away. And in fact, they faded away so much that in the fall, when swine flu really took off, there was no competition. The only flu that was circulating in the fall was swine flu. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because in the spring, there wasn't that much swine flu. I mean, it appeared, it was clear it was a new virus. Eventually, the WHO declared it a pandemic. But between the time it was identified and it was declared a pandemic was about 3 weeks or so, 3 or 4 weeks. And the reason it took 3 or 4 weeks is they had this definition of what a pandemic was. And, part of the pandemic is that it had to be, worldwide. And part of the definition is that there had to be community transmission. So the virus started out showing up. I mean, it was first identified in the United States. They kind of knew about it in Mexico, but there were all kind of confusing reports that were coming out saying it was seasonal flu and it was H3N2 and it was H1N1 and it was atypical pneumonia, and it wasn't really that clear what was going on in Mexico. In the United States, they identified it in a couple of children. And California, then they sequenced it. And once they sequenced it, they knew they had a novel swine flu. It was a triple reassortant, which had been seen before. So it had some of the genes were from humans, some of the genes were from swine, and some of the genes were from avian or birds. But instead of being all North American genes, some of the genes were Asian genes. So it was a mixture. It had North American, Asian as far as the origin, the geographical origin, and then it had three different species types. And so it was clear it was a novel virus. It was clear it was spreading human to human. The first two cases had no contact with swine or each other. And it was clear that it was going to be a problem. But even though all of that was clear as soon as the sequence came out, it took a while before it was declared a pandemic, because it started out with a few cases in the U.S. and a few cases in Mexico, and then there were a few cases in Canada. And then students that had been on spring break and had gone down to Mexico for spring break started to bring it back to their schools. And then it started to spread at the schools. But it wasn't spreading at all the schools. It was just spreading at select schools. And the CDC or WHO wouldn't declare it a pandemic because, you know, it was initially just in North America. And then it started showing up in South America. And again, it wasn't declared a pandemic because it was just in North and South America. And then it started showing up in Asia and Australia. But it wasn't a pandemic then because it was showing up in people that had flown to those countries from the U.S. or Mexico or Canada. And therefore, it wasn't really community transmission. These were just cases that had transported by air, and it had landed there, but it really wasn't spreading yet there. And then, and so they had to find cases by accident. So the ones that they screened as they were deplaning from North America and positive, they didn't count because they were really North American viruses. And they had to wait until they started accidentally finding cases locally. Mm-hmm. And then when that happened, they declared it a pandemic. So it took a while to be declared a pandemic. And then it wasn't that big of a deal in the spring. And I mean, I remember telling people here in Pittsburgh in the, you know, right before the school season began, that the swine flu was going to be coming to Box Chapel. And they just kind of looked at me like, well, I thought that was, you know, something that happened last spring. Is that still around? And that was kind of the general response. And then when it first came, like I said last week, it wasn't that bad. The kids were not missing school. They weren't even sick enough to go to the doctor. They kind of were coughing. It was some crud going around, quote unquote, and it didn't really take off until October or so. And the reason I'm bringing this up is just to give an idea what is likely to happen with COVID. That, you know, there's 200,000 dead in the U.S. There's 1 million dead in the world, and we haven't really gotten into the second wave, as in it kind of goes away and then it comes back with a vengeance. Yeah, I mean, some are saying, well, the second wave was the one that they're getting over, but it really wasn't a second wave. It was just a wave. It was kind of the first wave that was in the South and the Midwest.
Italian was a variant, right? Is that what you're going to call it, a variant or a mutation? What word was
that? Yeah, well, all of this was due to the Italian strain, essentially. The Italian strain took off, but it wasn't a second wave in the sense that the pandemics were a second wave. The pandemics kind of were, you know, they had something in the spring, and then it kind of went down over the summer, and then it came back in the fall, but it was much more intense in the fall. With the Italian strain, it just transmitted more efficiently, so that it hit people harder because you had more people coming in at the same time because it was transmitting more easily. But it wasn't really a second wave. It was really a first wave. And what people are calling a second wave is the activity that was mostly in the southern states. The ones that were leading the way were Florida, Texas, and California.
And
but
Georgia.
Right, but that's why I say those were the three that were leading. And then, and then the other southern states started increasing, and they really hadn't been hit that hard initially. So they really weren't a second wave. They were just the first wave in another area.
Sure.
And the difference is that the first wave is called a herald wave because it's just heralding in the virus, and it's kind of giving you a look at what the virus looks like, and it isn't spreading that widespread yet because it's just being introduced to the new species. And then once it's had those introductions, and once there's been some selection for individuals that have a high viral load, and then they can infect people with a higher dose of the virus, and then the virus can start to evolve away from any immunity that happened in the herald wave, then you have a kind of an explosion of cases, and that explosion of cases doesn't bounce around from one location to the next, which is what happened with the swine flu. The swine flu, I mean, here in Pittsburgh in the spring, there was very little. I know of one middle school that got hit, and that's about it as far as confirmed cases that I know about. But then in the fall, once it hit every school. They did a serological test to see if student age patients had swine flu antibodies. They found it was 40% of them. So it wasn't one school had it or another school had it. It's all the schools had it. All the schools didn't necessarily report it, but they all had it. 40% of the samples that had been collected in 2009, and these were all collected before the vaccine, 40% of the samples had swine flu antibodies. So 40% of the people, minimum, at least 40% had been infected with the virus before the flu season really even got going in October. So a lot of these samples were collected over the summer or early fall. The point is that once the virus got going, it went right up to 40% infected and probably even higher than that, and it wasn't a school here and a school there, or a city here or a city there. It was everywhere. And that hasn't happened yet with COVID. I mean, COVID's kind of going around regionally. There's not that much activity in the Northeast yet, but it's starting to creep up. And most of the activity was in the South. Now it's becoming more active in the Midwest. And this is somewhat like what things were in 2009. It really started in the South in the summer, like in August. It was in the South, and then when the schools in the North opened up the end of August, beginning of September, it started showing up. And in many cases, it was just like it was in Pittsburgh, where people were getting infected, but they weren't getting that sick and they weren't getting reported. And then 6 weeks into it, then they started having serious symptoms, and they had fevers, and they were going to the nurse's office, and they were, at least the ones with a fever, they were sending home. And they started getting absentee levels up to 10-12% or so for the students, and it's the same thing for the staff. So the point is that with swine flu, it was much more widespread and hit everywhere kind of at once in the fall, which is not what the case was in the spring. So for COVID, it also didn't hit everywhere at the same time in the spring. But in spite of the fact that it wasn't that widespread, it kind of went from place to place. And there's 200,000 people that are dead. And worldwide, there's a million that are dead. But that's in the Herald wave. So the real wave is going to hit in the fall. And you know, exactly when it's going to hit, you know, you can't make a direct comparison with COVID and
I've had a number of emails asking me to please ask you if you'll comment on the UCLA Stanford study, which is out recently, and it claims that the chance of death is in a random sense from coronavirus is 1 in 12.1 million. This is Stanford UCLA. The study's been rattling around and making a lot of noise. The two authors seem to be, I don't know if they're scientists or not, but they've got credentials. The abstract is clear. You've probably seen it. Let me just read a little bit of it to you just in case to bring everybody up to speed on this. Our objective is to demonstrate a method to estimate the probability of a laboratory confirmed coronavirus 19 infection, hospitalization, and death arising from a contact with an individual of unknown infection status. Methods. We calculate the probability of a confirmed infection, hospitalization, and death resulting from a county-level person contact using available data on current case incidents, secondary attack rates, infectious periods, asymptomatic infections, and ratios of confirmed infections to hospitalizations and fatalities. Results. This is the abstract. Among U.S. counties with populations greater than 500,000 people, during the week ending June 13, 2020, the median estimate of the county-level probability of a confirmed infection is one infection in 40,500 person contacts. For a 50 to 64-year-old individual, the median estimate of the county-level probability of a hospitalization is 1 in 709,000 person contacts. And one more here. Conclusions and relevance. Estimates of the individual probabilities of COVID-19 infection, hospitalization, and death vary widely, but may not align with public risk perceptions. Systematically collected and publicly reported data, let me finish, on infection incidents by, for example, the setting of exposure, type of residence, and occupation would allow more precise estimates of probabilities than possible with currently available public data. Calculation of secondary attack rates by setting and better measures of the prevalence of seropositivity would further improve those estimates. That's the abstract. It's getting a lot of play. Any insight
into
this?
Yeah, I'll bet it is. It's an obsolete study. I mean, give me a break. It ended in June. June, the distribution of the virus was only at a limited number of major metropolitan areas. So you've got a lot of people that basically didn't get exposure to the virus. And they're including asymptomatic people. So,
right.
I mean, once you start throwing in asymptomatic people, it's a stupid number. Because most people that are asymptomatic,
how can they factor in? I don't understand.
They don't see a doctor. You know, so,
that's what I'm saying. How can they factor in?
It's all. It's a. It, it's an. the best I could say is it's an obsolete observation. It's based on people in the beginning of the Herald mm-hmm. Wave, when the virus wasn't widespread, when it didn't, the Italian strain
right.
hadn't, right, the Italian strain is like virtually all the cases in the U.S. now. Back in June and prior to that, it was relatively rare throughout the country. It was in New York City. It was in the Northeast. It was in some of these cities that were the initial ones. But it's just nonsense. It's kind of I just gave you the whole story. Listen, I just gave you the whole story for swine flu.
Got it.
And it's like saying, well, there weren't many cases of swine flu by June. That it was kind of scattered, and your chance of dying from swine flu was very low, and the chance of being hospitalized was very low. But that's not what happened in the fall. In the fall, it was everywhere. In the spring, it was sporadic. You just read a study that talked about what the virus was like when it was sporadic. It doesn't have anything to do with what it's going to be like when it really hits.
So this study probably encompassed the months
and the numbers you gave about dying is just a nonsense number. There's 200,000 dead in the U.S., and that's an underestimate. So what number did you get on death? It was some ridiculous number. There's already 200,000 that are dead.
I can dig it up.
Yeah, well, it isn't even worth digging up. It's a stupid study. It's an early study. They can't extrapolate it. It's old data. It's when the virus first appeared, and it doesn't have anything to do with anything. And it uses asymptomatic, so you get a big denominator. And it's, you know, the fact that people got infected, they're asymptomatic, they probably don't have much immunity. If they do have immunity, it's probably gone already. Yeah. These are efforts to try to minimize what's happening. And the fact that there are, like I said, you can look at excess deaths, and you can see the excess deaths are like 1918. That was called the big one. 50 right. million people in the world died from 1980. Something like, I think 600,000 ended up dying in the United States from 1918. This pandemic is on a par with 1918. So these guys that are looking at what happened real early in the pandemic mm-hmm. is a historic document. It's not a predictive document. It tells you what happens when pandemics begin, not what happens when pandemics get going. So
well, I'm curious to see
study.
What's going to happen in Florida in 3 weeks. That's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
As we move into flu season, as we move near the election.
It's not going to just be Florida. I mean, Indiana's doing the same thing.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They're at their final stage. Everything, they're good to go. These are stupid politicians.
Well, you know this is all heading
these are stupid politicians who have no science background, and they're looking at the calendar. They're not looking at how many people are dead. They're not looking at how many people are infected. They're not looking at what the history and epidemiology of a pandemic is. They're looking at the calendar. They're trying to say things are normal. The election's coming up. Time to get back to work. Read the New York Times article where Dr. Kushner and Dr. Kudlow and Dr.
That's one of the funniest
Meadows.
Things I've heard in a long time.
Right,
honestly,
right.
Dr. Jerry,
they're all
Christmas.
Weighing wow. in for critical edits. on what parents should do with their children. They should listen to these whack jobs that have no scientific background to send their kids to school so they can get infected and figure everything's going to be fine because these politicians decided that it's time to go back to school. I mean, Trump wanted them to go back to school for Easter, before Easter. He wanted them to go back to school last spring. These guys have nothing to do with science, nothing to do with the virus. It's nothing to do with controlling a pandemic. They don't have a plan yet. The pandemic started almost a year ago. What is the plan in the U.S.? Is to put out propaganda. That's their plan. That's how they plan on with controlling the virus.
Hey, my plan. When did I roll my plan out?
They're going to put out propaganda pieces by politicians and put it out under the CDC's name.
It's
like
it's,
there's science behind it.
When did I roll my plan out? In January. My plan was very simple. If there's a real issue here, and at that point, we weren't 100% sure, but it looked like it. You knew what was coming, but most Americans. I said, we're supposed to have a strategic reserve. If there's a real emergency confronting this society, the administration should immediately, or they can send out mass mailers to everybody in this country, provide everyone with masks, teach them how to use them, and attack it that way.
They had a plan. They were going to send out 5 masks per household or per person.
And it was canceled. I know.
Right.
I said that long before they did.
Yeah. I
don't think they were in January.
It is poorly planned. And the fact that it was a novel coronavirus came out at the end of December. The sequence came out, I think, January 8th. As soon
That's
as
the first night we did
out,
a program on this. That's the first
As soon as the sequence came out, there was no doubt there was a problem. Because this was the SARS version 2. You know, it's COVID-2. It was closer to SARS than any other sequence out there. It wasn't close to MERS. It was close to SARS. But as soon as it was exported, as soon as it showed up in Thailand and Japan, and it started to come out so quick that the guys that wrote up a paper on it wrote up a paper when there were 2. And by the time it was ready to come out, which is a matter of days, there were already 3. So they had to edit the paper. And you could tell that they were editing the paper because parts of it they didn't really edit. So parts of it they were talking about 2 viruses, and parts of it they were talking about 3 viruses. And they said that because the population is 19 million in Wuhan, if you have 3 viruses that are out there, that means you've got tens of thousands of cases already. So if you got tens of thousands of cases, they didn't all go to a seafood market that is transmitting human to human. So you knew it was human to human. You knew it was SARS-like. And if you read the sequence, you saw it had a polybasic cleavage site. That's all bad news. And that's all known in January. In early January, you knew what the sequence was. And there was exports by, I don't know the exact days, probably by the end of January. So it's the end of September. The U.S. still doesn't have a plan. They still don't have enough N95 masks. They still
haven't been wartime production mentality here.
Right.
None of that.
And they're putting out propaganda pieces talking about, you know, round the corner or whatever they said. You know, they're in the final leg of this. They're talking about
rounding the final corner. They're coming into the home stretch.
This is in the rear view window kind of stuff. I mean, when's the last time Pence said, "I don't see a second wave"? He said that in the summertime. He's not saying that in the fall because he knows it's already starting.
Well, all I can say is the influenza at the door, 2-3 weeks away. The election, the hysteria, the anguish, the stress. This whole culture is liable to shake itself apart. It's not good right now for a variety of reasons. And having this pandemic on top of it is the coup de grace in some people's estimation. We're in real trouble.
Yeah, well, the pandemic's going to drive everything. And it's not in the rearview mirror.
No, when you've had 7 million out of 327 million infected. No. No. That's it. All right, Henry, thank you. Jeez, it's Monday. All right, we'll watch, see what happens. I know you'll have your popcorn for the debate tomorrow night, and good grief, that's all I can say.
Okay, talk to you soon. Take care. Okay, bye-bye. Yeah.
All right. Okay, there we go. Tomorrow night is the great debit. The great debit. The political debit. We'll see if the creeper can pharmacologically perform. But listen to how he pronounces his sentences. They're not right. I'm just telling you. The words come out, but they're not accented and nuanced properly. Okay, back with you tomorrow. It's going to be interesting. See you then.